Hello out there in cyberspace. This is Steve Darnall welcoming you to the Nostalgia Digest podcast, our monthly series dedicated to people, performers, topics, and shows that have been featured in the pages of Nostalgia Digest magazine, now beginning its 43rd year. On this edition of the Nostalgia Digest podcast, it's our 5th anniversary, and we're celebrating with a 2.5-hour spectacular, featuring some great sounds from the golden age of radio, a few of our favorite memories from podcasts past, and our present-day conversations with author Cheryl Honigford, musician Chris Legan, cartoonist Heather McAdams, and actress Tanya Richard. The Nostalgia Digest podcast is brought to you by NostalgiaDigest.com, the home of the audiophile Nostalgia Shop, where you'll find hundreds of hours of classic old-time radio on compact disc. Everything from comedies to mysteries, from World War II broadcasts to the music of the big bands, and a page devoted to sale and clearance items. NostalgiaDigest.com is also the home of Nostalgia Digest magazine, the quarterly publication dedicated to chronicling and celebrating the golden age of entertainment. The upcoming winter 2017 issue of Nostalgia Digest has a cover story about Eve Arden and Our Miss Brooks, and a cover photo of Eve Arden preparing to celebrate the holidays. The winter issue of Nostalgia Digest also has the story of how William Powell and Myrna Loy became Hollywood's favorite crime-solving couple thanks to the Thin Man movies. In addition, you'll find articles about The Man from U.N.C.L.E., the career of Henry Fonda, Edgar Allan Poe on radio, the transformative voice of the great Marian Anderson, the man who shaped Chicago's lakefront, performers who risked their lives entertaining the troops, and how Eleanor and Franklin Roosevelt celebrated Christmas at the White House. You'll find memories of the young man who was Jack Benny's violin student, and actor William Daniels recalls his career as a child singer on radio. Plus, every issue of Nostalgia Digest has a complete 3-month schedule for our weekly radio show, Those Were the Days. Nostalgia Digest makes a great gift for a friend, a loved one, or for you. A 1-year subscription is only $17, a 2-year subscription only $30, and you can subscribe today when you visit NostalgiaDigest.com. And NostalgiaDigest.com is also where you can get past editions of the Nostalgia Digest podcast from 2012, 2013, 2014, and 2015 on compact disc. Each disc contains a dozen MP3 files, totaling over 9 hours of classic Golden Age entertainment. And you can order 1, 2, 3, or all 4 CDs from the podcast page at NostalgiaDigest.com. Well, since launching the Nostalgia Digest podcast in January of 2012, we've devoted each edition to featuring people and performers, topics and shows that we've also featured within the pages of our Nostalgia Digest magazine. Sort of an electronic version of a magazine article, if you will. But for this 5th anniversary celebration, we decided to try something a little different, and that is to bring to the microphone some very talented people who have taken their affection and enthusiasm for the golden age of entertainment and channeled it into new and interesting works. At the same time, we're looking forward to sharing a few of our favorite moments from the 5 years of the Nostalgia Digest podcast. When we began the podcast in response to requests from listeners to our Those Were the Days program, it made perfect sense to start by bringing to the microphone the man who founded both Nostalgia Digest and Those Were the Days, Radio Hall of Famer Chuck Shaden.
Thank you very much for inviting me to be on this maiden voyage.
Well, thank you. We'll hope that everything is sealed up properly. You started Those Were the Days in 1970, mm-hmm. and then you began Nostalgia Digest in 1974, although it began as the Nostalgia Newsletter and Radio Guide. What was the impetus for creating a publication at that time?
Well, we were looking to have some communications with the listeners. And I had initially asked listeners if t- tell me, when I first went on the air in 1970, I said, tell me what you'd like to hear on the air of the old-time radio shows that we were playing. And I thought, I get a lot of ideas from them because we had a lot of product. And wouldn't get many calls. Someone say, who's on first? Or someone say, oh, I want to hear the Bickersons or something like that. But I thought, gee whiz, is there anybody there? Is anybody listening? You know, taking a line from War of the Worlds.
That's right.
Is there anybody there? But I decided then to say, if you would send me a box top, any kind of a box top, using the idea from the old kids' shows.
Sure, of course.
I will send you a list of the programs that we're going to play on Saturday afternoons, and we'll put you on our mailing list and see, then you'll know what we're doing. So I got 400 box tops in the first week.
Wow.
And so now I know there are people out there. So yeah, first of all, you know, is anybody there? No. So then we started sending out a publication, a little flyer almost, a mailing flyer. It's paid for, a mailing paid for by the sponsor, one of the main first sponsors, the savings and loan. And we were doing every 6 weeks we'd have this mailing and send out that sort of thing. And we started doing that. And the list was growing and growing and growing. And finally, the financial institution that sponsored us says, you know, the list is getting bigger and bigger. And our marketing department is getting smarter. And we thought, they sent out a monthly publication, a newsletter for the business. Open your savings account here. Here's the mortgage rates and stories about helping home ownership and helping you save and so forth. And we'll devote a column in each month to listing what your programming is. Fine. I love that because, first of all, it encouraged the sponsor to continue sponsoring the program
all
of that sort of thing. And they were really getting response. And so we started doing that, and we told people that the listings would be now in the publication that the sponsor had, and you can get on that mailing list simply by having an account at the savings and loan, either a savings account in any amount, or if you happen to have a mortgage there or whatever it is, you know. Well, all of a sudden, the people are going into the bank and signing up. They're opening new accounts. They're doing all kinds of stuff like that. And, you know, and the sponsor said, you know, we put money from billboards into the radio show, but we never had anybody walk in, open up accounts specifically because they liked our billboards, you know. So this was great. So now that was going on. And finally, my own little marketing side of my brain says, you know, if people are opening up accounts to get the listing of what Those Were the Days is playing, maybe they would like to have a little newsletter that would not only have the listings of the material in there, which would be perhaps a little more extensive than what the bank was having in their publication.
Sure.
And also some articles from and about the past, as I always used to say. So we tested it out. We said, if you'd like to subscribe to our new nostalgia newsletter, it's a simple publication. It was really only 6 pages, like a gatefold, 8.5 by 11. And they started subscribing. It was going to be mailed first-class mail every month, and it would be $5. So we started with that, and the subscriptions came in. It was okay, and $5 was a great price for it. It covered our printing costs, and it covered our postage when postage wasn't $5.
That's right. Wow, yeah.
and all of that sort of thing. So then that evolved, and people started getting into it all. And so we decided, with a journalism background, working in newspapers and other things, I decided we would develop into a little, from a newsletter to a digest of articles and the listings and all of that stuff. And it was a wonderful marketing tool, and everybody benefited because I loved doing it. Mm-hmm. It helped the broadcast, and the people who were subscribers were enjoying it, and they were looking forward to it.
Sure.
As you have found out subsequently, people look forward to it. You know, if I usually get this on the last week of the month, if where is it? You know, I'm just out a little late. Well, I want to know. Okay.
Or they'll get something in November for the winter issue, and then they'll say, immediately they'll call the next day and say, oh, I see on March 21st you're doing this. That'll be wonderful.
Yeah, right. Oh, exactly. Exactly.
That's an excerpt from our very first Nostalgia Digest podcast, featuring Nostalgia Digest founder and Those Were the Days founder, Chuck Shaden. That podcast is available currently on the Nostalgia Digest Podcast 2012 CD, and information about that is available at nostalgiadigest.com. I've had the pleasure of knowing Tanya Richard for more than 30 years. Going back to the days when we were teenagers performing in summer theater in LaGrange, Illinois. Since then, Tanya has made her Broadway debut in the Steppenwolf Theater's production of The Song of Jacob Zulu, and she's been a fixture of Chicago theater, performing with the Second City, the Court Theater, and the Goodman Theater, where for two seasons she played Mrs. Cratchit in the Goodman Theater's annual productions of A Christmas Carol. She is the author of numerous plays and two books, including My So-Called Unexpected Life, a memoir about her marriage and the family she joined through that marriage. The life chronicled in that book became the focus of Tanya's internet television series, Mom in Real Life, which began its second season in December of 2016. Mom in Real Life is a gently comical look at the modern-day challenges of balancing marriage, children, and career in a world where everyone is an entrepreneur and everything demands your attention. We sat down with Tanya Richard in November of 2016, and I asked her what led her to make the jump from being a mom in real life to creating Mom in Real Life.
I feel like one of the big catalysts for me wanting to create the series was being a mom, being a wife, being in a professional world as well. I wanted transparency with other people who were attempting to juggle all of those things. And I think culturally sometimes what will happen is people all kind of fake it. Like everything, you know, it's the sort of Facebook version of everything, the highlight reel version of people's lives, so that nobody is admitting that it's challenging or that, you know, actually I'm really bad at this, that, or the other thing. And then the other layer of that is I have a sense of humor about those things and I love to laugh at myself. So I combine the idea of like creating transparency about the challenges of being a mom and a wife and a woman with a career, and then making fun of it and sort of celebrating all the fails that are, you know, inevitable.
Was there a moment, was there a single event or anecdote or whatever that led you from thinking funny things happen in my position to I should do a series about funny things happening?
Yeah, you know, and actually it comes actually from one of my jobs, because I have multiple, being an actress and a teacher and a writer. So as a teacher over at Columbia College Chicago, I had I like to always reference sort of things happening currently for my students. And the film last year, Tangerine, which was shot entirely on an iPhone, that got a lot of attention at Sundance, that really struck me as like, this group of people decided to tell a story and they didn't wait for you know, some big studio to come and pay for everything. They were like, we have iPhones, we're gonna film this on our iPhone. And I brought that story to my students to try to inspire them to be constantly thinking about how and when can I create my own content. And then I heard myself talking and doing sort of the inspirational talk, and I was like, wait a second, I have an iPhone, I have a story. And so I just started thinking about what's the quickest sort of bridge in terms of what story can I tell, where, you know, I'm not sitting there in a think tank trying to come up with the subject matter. And I thought, look at my life, you know, and that also must have been on my mind, that idea of the transparency and trying to build connections based in that truth. So really one weekend I recruited my daughters. One is 9 now and the other is 6. And, you know, they became my creative directors and my camera people. And we shot a very raw first episode on my iPhone. And from there, I started seeking funding so I could work with a little bit more official cameras and start building a collaborative team. And we were off to the races and created the first season. So, yeah, it really came out of sort of posing a challenge to my students and then realizing, hey, the challenge is also being posed to me.
Fair enough. So how does a typical episode of Mom in Real Life come together?
You know, I realized there was a little bit of cart before the horse. I sought funding from Columbia College Chicago, which has a part-time faculty grant, which is great. You know, it gives us an opportunity to fund projects outside of our teaching and continue in our careers in our field. And so I applied for that grant and sort of started figuring out where the money should be allocated. Still didn't have any scripts yet, but, you know, started gathering ideas and sort of banking what topics might be funny. And then it was sort of towards the end of all of that that I was like, oh, it's maybe time to write the scripts. And so then I wrote the, I think it's 6 or 7 scripts, I think, for the first season, along with some mini-sodes. And then the casting process started. And, you know, so, it, you know, sometimes people start with the script and then they seek the funding, but I kind of flipped it. But it worked out.
So these are formally scripted as opposed to the sort of Curb Your Enthusiasm style where a premise is presented and people work within that.
Yes, they are scripted. I write the episodes and I have a brilliant actor, John Lister, who plays my husband, who has such an improvisational style in his acting that it might appear that they're improvised. But we also have a great sort of energy between each other and a banter. And there are some moments that came out of an improvised moment, which was really fun to discover and keep because I love a happy accident. So, but no, John just has that ability to make scripted material seem improvised.
There is a quote that's been credited to a number of people, I think most prominently Elvis Costello, who talked about early in his songwriting career, he would very often create havoc in his life so he'd have things about which to write. I'm going to assume you probably haven't gone quite that conscious route.
No.
But do you find yourself, I mean, how much of you is the script writer in real life? That is, say, are you jotting down notes every time you're with your friends?
Yes.
Okay.
Well, so that makes a couple things come to mind. Number one, to quote Nora Ephron, everything is copy. And if you're friends with a writer,
Don't
be surprised. So my friends have joked, like, they'll tell me something and be like, don't write about it, you know? But they know that, you know, they may be the sacrificial lamb. And I'm kind in when if I do use something that inspires me. But in this case, the stories are constantly around me. I'm constantly jotting down notes. And then literally my daughters are listed as in the credits as creative directors because they get it. They understand the character of Rory because, you know, basically my daughter said, basically, Rory is you, you know? And it's like, yeah, that's kind of true. She's really is just a variation of me. So occasionally I'll do something that's very quote-unquote Rory-like, and one of my daughters will be like, you should use that for Mom in Real Life. And then I'm like, oh, yeah, I should. And they've come up with some of the jokes, some of the funnier moments are because of something they've come up with. So together, we're just sort of observant of the life we're living and recognizing when we might amp it up for story fodder.
And there are some, you talk about the minisodes, minisodes.
Yes.
And there is one, at the risk of giving anything away, absolutely adore, Look Mommy.
Oh, yes.
And for those who have not seen it, this is about, what, 2 minutes?
I think it might only be a minute. I have 2 versions, possibly.
Okay.
One that's like, yeah, but it's pretty brief.
But it is Rory,
yes,
at the park with her daughter, who is playing on the swings and the merry-go-round, the carousel and whatnot. And Rory is desperately trying to close her eyes for about 5 seconds. And the moment she does, out comes the little girl, Look, mommy, look.
Yes. That was at the end of a long summer where I think I had, you know, I made some decision that they were only going to do 2 weeks of camp, which on paper looks great. And I love the idea because I do like doing a degree of camp mom. So we're spending time together in the summer. But that was the first summer I'd made that lovely choice. And so we had a lot of together time. So by the end of the summer, a lot of moms and dads, I think, can relate that, like, your child crossing the monkey bars for the 100th time and then wanting you to watch them the entire time is a bit daunting. And yes, I've had a lot of people actually mention that particular episode to me. And I actually tried to shoot that episode one day where I was a little at the end of the rope with my girls. And I had to actually cut a certain part of it, tighten the frame, because I was trying to get the shot and my daughter was behind me like crawling around. So, and I was like, you know, I'm trying to get this shot. So, you know, it was sort of cathartic, I think, for me to be able to shoot that episode and especially to have people relate to it. Cause, you know, they really, and it's, you know, they really want every time to be the first time and it really just isn't.
It's like that scene in Family Guy where Lois is just sitting on the couch, absolutely bug-eyed, and Stewie's just, Mom, Mommy, what?
Yes.
Hi.
That, yes.
Oh,
and,
my Lord.
And sadly, my children have seen that and like to occasionally do that. And sometimes my husband will encourage them to do it. I'm like, yeah, okay, that's really, it's funny, but actually, no, it's not.
No, it's not. I know you studied at Second City.
Yes.
And of course, many years ago, when we were both much younger, you and I worked together in LaGrange Summer Theater doing Gypsy. We were both in The Music Man and Bye Bye Birdie.
Yep.
I'd be curious to know, because looking back, it's obvious there was talent there. This was not just a case of some teenage girl who wanted to just sing the loudest or anything. Who were some of the influences on you in terms of comedy? The people who made you think that's a way I'd like to live. You know, I mean, are there those from the past, those from more recent years?
You know, that's so interesting. And the first thing that comes to mind is that I grew up in a family that appreciated my humor. Mm-hmm. Some of the most satisfying laughs I ever got were when I made my sort of stoic Haitian parents laugh. And, you know, it's not like they were like a joke a minute type of people, mm-hmm. but they had a sense of humor or appreciated humor in a way that allowed me to start to craft it. And then when I met people at the summer theater that we did, I sort of started finding my tribe in terms of the type of humor that amused me and the type of humor that I would put out sort of was appreciated. And then at Second City, I think, is where I sort of learned about the timing of it all. Mm-hmm. And I remember a class in college, actually, that a teacher had us memorize Elaine May and
Mike Nichols.
Oh. And the assignment strictly was memorize a sketch of theirs. And we had to do it verbatim, the pauses, the hems, the haws, the stutter, everything. And I'll never forget that because I took it very seriously, that assignment. And I, to this day, point to that to be what taught me about comic timing.
Wow. Do you remember the sketch?
Oh, gosh, I don't. I remember, I wish I did, but it was a particular sketch, and I really, I don't know, something subconsciously was like, she's not just asking you to, you know, fill time here. Focus on this.
Oh, yes.
Hear the music, and it's absolutely, I feel like everything I know about comedy, I learned from that exercise.
That's remarkable, and yes, Nichols and May were, mm-hmm. I mean, it's easy to forget just how groundbreaking that was, because these were actors doing comedy. These were not comedians.
Yes. You know,
this was not Jan Murray or Sid Caesar.
Yes. And the undercurrent of the timing and the give and take, and it's gorgeous. If you listen to those recordings, and so, yeah. And then I'm just fortunate to know a heck of a lot of funny people. And more importantly than that, people who are willing to laugh at themselves. You know?
It is a delight. And the second season of Mom in Real Life is launched December 1st, 2016, yes. The day this podcast goes live.
Oh, no, I didn't realize that.
How about that?
Wow.
So, yes, perhaps the moment you're done listening to us today, you can go over to mominreallife.net.
Whoop. That was my cell phone. I'm blowing up, you see?
Oh, my God. Yeah, we haven't even posted this, and already you're getting calls.
It's remarkable.
This is tremendous. The buzz is marvelous. All right, well, we'll just say once more. The second season of Mom in Real Life premieres December 1st, 2016 at mominreallife.net. Tanya Richard, my goodness, I'm so grateful to Carl Menninger for casting us both in Gypsy all those years ago so that 30-odd years later we could be sitting here in your living room having this conversation about your wonderful series.
Well, thank you. Me too. And I was just so thrilled when you asked, and all you listeners out there who have been listening to Steve, he was a brilliant actor. Even when we were kids, I knew it then.
Oh,
and
you
continue to do great things. So thank you for taking the time, really.
Bless your heart. Thank you, Tanya.
Our conversation with writer and actress Tanya Richard, recorded at her home in November of 2016, and presented for you on this fifth anniversary edition of the Nostalgia Digest podcast. It's always nice to spend time with someone who admires the comedy of Mike Nichols and Elaine May, who, believe it or not, actually have some radio history. Mike Nichols, in fact, was one of the first announcers on Chicago's WFMT more than 60 years ago. But Mike Nichols and Elaine May created a lot of comedy for NBC's ambitious weekend series, Monitor. And since we were talking with Tanya Richard about her comedy and the influence of Mike Nichols and Elaine May, we thought you might like to hear an excerpt from a Monitor program that was heard originally over NBC on a Saturday afternoon, September 26, 1964. The man monitoring the Monitor beacon is actor Barry Nelson, who introduces Mike Nichols and Elaine May.
It's Monitor comedy time. Mike Nichols and Elaine May. Should a tall man marry a short girl? Well, of course not. That is, if he doesn't love her. But suppose he does. Ah, that's where Nichols and May come in.
This is Honey Galen for Monitor, and today we're going to interview Ben McCready, who is the tallest man in the world. Hello there, Mr. McCready.
Hello, Miss Galen.
Mr. McCready, how does it feel to be a giant?
Well, you get used to it, Miss Galen. I've been 8 feet tall since I was 16 years old.
Mm-hmm.
And you learn to live with it. You try to stand up straight and not slump.
Yeah, I imagine that points it up.
That's right.
Yeah. Do you go out with girls?
Yes, I do. I as a matter of fact, I'm engaged to a very lovely young lady.
Mm-hmm.
We're quite happy together. She's forgotten about my height.
Oh,
I've found ways to disguise it with clothes.
Yeah, I imagine. Different cuts.
There are certain colors that a tall person shouldn't wear because they only call attention to him.
Mm-hmm.
But if I avoid pinstripes or loud checked material, I can manage to disguise my height.
Tell me, how tall is the lady that you're engaged to?
She's 4'8".
She is. Do you two have any trouble dancing?
We've made our adjustment. It's pretty much the same as with any two people who have some physical difference. It's a problem at first, but then when you grow to love each other and grow to respect each other's feelings, it's not the problem that it was.
Well, a lot of people would think you might have some difficulty adjusting to being tall, but you feel that there really isn't too much difference between you and, say, the average man.
I think inside everyone is exactly the same.
Well, I noticed that from the waist up, you are the same size as any normal man. It's only your legs that make for your height.
Yes, I have very long legs. Often, when I stand up, people are amazed.
Yes, it's like the opposite of that Toulouse-Lautrec movie. You
yeah.
Know, you just keep going. But, of course, that helps because your hands fall in the right place. They would almost drag on the floor if
yes,
you're...
Yes, I need that length of leg. It keeps my hands from dragging on the ground.
Yes. Thank you very much, Mr. McCready.
Well, it's been a pleasure for me, too, Miss Galen. And very unusual to meet someone who's taller than I am.
Wow, that's what's fun about radio. I don't have to see her. I know she's 8'7".
Actor Barry Nelson as the host of Monitor, introducing the comedy of Mike Nichols and Elaine May. It's the 5th anniversary edition of the Nostalgia Digest podcast, and we're looking back at the golden age of radio, but we're also looking back at the first 5 years of the Nostalgia Digest podcast. It's always a pleasure to get to talk to people for the podcast, to share their stories, to share their knowledge. And it's especially gratifying when we can do that with a friend. As was the case when we sat down for the February 2013 podcast with award-winning comic book artist Alex Ross to talk ostensibly about radio and the golden age of superheroes. But eventually the conversation turned to those artists who defined the golden age of comics, and inevitably to one artist in particular.
Whatever circumstances were coming together, economically or socially or whatever, there was clearly something about the early artwork, as basic as some of it was, that clearly was very powerful to an entire generation of kids.
Yeah, and I guess there still has to be something to it because there's plenty of people like myself who have come to it who obviously weren't there for that original stuff, and we find just as much engagement and excitement about seeing that old stuff that we want to collect it. That's not purely, it can't be based on nostalgia because nostalgia for what? A period we weren't alive
for? Right, you weren't there, yeah.
You know, so if I become excited about anything from the 30s or 40s, I'm not nostalgic for something of my own youth. It wasn't my youth. You know, I'm just fascinated with a period of design and execution of certain things. So, you know, it'd be like being some history buff where you like to see stories set in ancient Egypt or during the Civil War or whatever place in the world that you become engaged with.
That's true, and there's one fellow we haven't talked about, and we should at least mention him, and it's what makes the emergence of somebody like Jack Kirby, who did so much to define what the medium of comics was and mm-hmm. is about, and even going back 70 years to the early strips that Kirby did on Captain America or The Guardian and the Newsboy Legion, and you can already sort of tell this is somebody who's taken the stuff of 1938 and 39 and just leapfrogged into the future.
Yeah, to describe it for anybody who doesn't know who Jack Kirby is, aside from co-creating some of the most famous characters in comics with Marvel and some really great ones with DC as well, he brought energy to comics in a way that had not been seen before him. All the illustrators I mentioned from the 30s, people like Raymond, Foster, Schuster, and Kane, they never had this sort of magical touch of making the work kinetically leap off the page. Mm-hmm. It almost seemed like kinetic motion didn't exist in comics until Kirby's arrival. And he brought this fluidity of the shape of bodies where he was bending them like putty in a way to respond to the emotions of what the reader needed to feel for the character's exaggeration. Some of it was comically based initially. You know, you could look at these earliest strips he did. You know, he came first from drawing things like Popeye and then working on a Blue Beetle strip till eventually he got to create the character Captain America for Marvel. He had this way of drawing limbs that would force perspective in ways that hadn't been seen in comics before. And he, as a craftsman, continued this line of exaggerated art that inspired countless artists in his time. When he first emerged in the 40s, there was enormous amounts of copycats of his work back then, mm-hmm. but he continued being the leader of his field all the way through the 50s till his ultimately his retirement in the early 80s, but he got better as time went on. By the time he was doing the work he was doing with Stan Lee, co-creating the Marvel Universe in the 1960s, his work in, I believe, his mid-40s became such a far cry better than his work in his 20s that, you know, here's a man who'd experienced war, gone off to fight World War II, and had done just hundreds of comics up to this point, and he was only proving to get better, to become much more expansive in his ability for drawing as well as his ability for creation, because his ability to create and conceive characters grew in his middle-aged years. Mm-hmm. You know, in his 50s, he was continuing to just blow out these enormous ideas and take things in directions that hadn't been done. And he had a pride and a zeal for it that he wanted to show, like, how far things could go. And everybody was really just behind him. So even though you began by the period of the 70s, which I was born into, you had illustrators that would take things maybe further than Kirby was capable of himself. Illustrators like John Buscema and Neil Adams, whose art styles were more realistic, more trained. They still could never really hold a candle to the creativity of this one man. So the art field of comics is more emboldened by his presence than just about any field in American comic books.
An excerpt of our conversation with award-winning comic book artist Alex Ross, which was part of the February 2013 Nostalgia Digest podcast. And that podcast is available on our Nostalgia Digest podcast 2013 CD at nostalgiadigest.com. Alex Ross's work can be found at alexrossart.com. And we're pleased for the chance to share a few moments from our conversation with Alex on this fifth anniversary edition of the Nostalgia Digest podcast. Earlier this year, I had occasion to read a debut novel by a young woman named Cheryl Hunningford. The novel, The Darkness Knows, published by Source Books. It's a murder mystery set in 1938 at a radio station in Chicago, where young actress Vivian Witchell, star of the weekly series The Darkness Knows, stumbles upon a corpse and finds herself in the protective custody of Detective Charlie Haverman. It's a well-crafted story and one that will appeal to fans of the Golden Age of radio and to those who might remember the Chicago of old, even though Cheryl Hunningford was not around for either of those things. So, when we sat down and spoke with Cheryl Hunningford, I asked her how it was that she got into the Golden Age of radio. What was her gateway drug?
My gateway drug, I think, was the gateway drug of many people into old-time radio. It's the Orson Welles War of the Worlds broadcast. In the eighth grade, my reading teacher, Sister Barbara Jean, pulled out the old cassette recorder one day, and she played that for us, and I was just mesmerized.
Do you, thinking back, can you say what it was that mesmerized you?
I think it was just the immediacy. It was just so different. You know, the very beginning of that, it seems like it's real. You know, it's interrupting a live broad feed from a ballroom, in quotes, right?
That's right?
It was just so far ahead of its time. You know, it really pulled you in to the story.
Did you have a picture in your mind of what the Martians looked like?
Oh, I don't know. I have to think about that.
I mean, I know there was some description in the course of the broadcast, but...
You know, I think my description in my head, I think, was a little bit influenced by what I had already seen. You know, I was probably 13 at the time,
sure.
So I think I imagined the aliens from The Day the Earth Stood Still.
Oh, pretty
that,
good.
That old
okay.
sci-fi movie. Yeah.
Right. So, fast forward from the age of 13 into adulthood.
Yeah.
Tell us a little something, if you will, about the impetus to write The Darkness Knows. You clearly absorbed these shows on some level. But what led you to being a fan of old-time radio and making the leap to writing a mystery about the golden age of radio?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think about the time that I heard War of the Worlds on cassette, that's dating me, it was on cassette, right? I saw the Woody Allen movie Radio Days. You've probably seen or familiar with that.
Of course.
It was on, I don't know, the movie channel at the time, so it was played thousands of times in a couple of months, and I would watch it every time it was on. So that also really hooked me. So in the intervening years, I would listen to, you could get radio shows on CDs, so I would listen to them in the car and things like that. But what really changed for me was the internet.
Sure.
So about 10 years ago, I would say, I found myself at a desk job where I had a lot of time to myself, not a lot of interaction with other people. So I discovered that you could listen to all these old-time radio shows on the internet.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what I ended up doing, and I've probably listened to thousands of hours of old-time radio shows sitting at my desk, working away. So I've absorbed a lot about the shows just by doing that.
So were there any shows or performers in particular that inspired this story or the characters in it?
I actually am not a great fan of detective old-time radio shows, believe it or not. I actually love the scary shows, so I love the Lights Out. Suspense is my absolute favorite.
Great show.
But what inspired the actual characters is when I started writing it, I needed a show that was a serial, or that was basically the same every week. Mm-hmm. And those sorts of scary shows like Lights Out were different every
week. That's true. They were anthologies.
So, yeah. Right. So I couldn't, it would be hard for me to get the same actors in the studio doing the same parts. So that's why it became a detective show in the book.
But at the same time, I mean, if you had no particular affection for radio detectives, you clearly had some affection for the detective genre.
Yeah, I think that's just, it goes along with absorbing all of those shows over the years. You know, I have listened to a lot of detective shows.
Sure.
You know, Box 13 springs to mind. I think that was Alan Ladd,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, that's right.
You know, and what's he called? Dashiell Hammett.
Oh,
the,
well, there was, well, I mean, I was going to say, I assumed you had,
eludes me.
You had some upbringing in the Thin Man movies. With
yes,
William Powell,
yes,
and Myrtle
love
Loy.
The Thin Man movies, yeah,
Because that's clearly the same sort of dynamic. Of
Yeah, it is. It wasn't intentional, actually. And while I was writing the second book, I added that reference in there because a lot of people have said, you know, they get that dynamic from Viv and Charlie. So we have someone mentioning that to them in the second book.
Oh, how nice.
Yeah.
One of the things I've really enjoyed about The Darkness Knows is that it's clearly the work of someone with an awareness of the time in terms of how radio worked, in terms of the sorts of shows that were being produced, in terms of the shows that were being produced in Chicago, which was a major radio center, but also in terms of knowing the layout of the city. I mean, you clearly, it looks to me like you clearly did the research to tell you what was where in 1930 Chicago.
Absolutely.
I'd be curious to know how much you knew going in and how much you ended up having to research in either direction during the course of writing the book.
Going in, I knew a lot going in. I actually lived in Lakeview for the first 7 years of my time here in Chicago.
Okay.
And I did a lot of architecture tours, just a lot of historical type things in the city itself. So I knew a lot of that going in, but I actually brought it with me today. I have a... it's like the graph paper.
Oh, my goodness. Okay.
Graph paper with the squares, and I plotted out the streets of Chicago.
Oh, my gosh.
And then I figured out from my reading where buildings were, and I actually put them on this map I made so that I could have it straight in my head when I was writing the book.
So a visual reference that allowed you to say, oh, from here to here is...
Right. A lot of things aren't in Chicago anymore. I mean, they're long gone, you know, department stores, for example, on State Street, a lot of them are gone or they're called something else these days. So I had to really dig and find what it would have looked like in 1938.
Absolutely. One of the other interesting things about The Darkness Knows is that As we said, you clearly understand something about radio history and Chicago radio, and to the point where the supporting characters all make perfect sense. You know, in the sense that, yes, there's the sort of supercilious leading man who fancies himself perhaps to be tougher than he actually is.
Right.
But then you have the little person who is famous for child voices and babies crying and that sort of thing. And, of course, there were direct antecedents for that. We asked earlier if there were any direct inspirations for Vivian or Charlie. Were there any that came to mind in terms of the other characters? For instance, you've got Sammy, the little person.
Actually, I got the inspiration for that character from an edition of the Radio Guide from 1938.
Oh my gosh.
I got a whole stack of those off of eBay from 1938 and just poured through every line of those to glean inspiration. And there was a feature article about, I can't recall the actor's name, but it was a feature article about him. He was a little person and how he played children. Sure. He made a career out of playing children on the radio.
It is amazing. And there were actresses who spent their whole lives playing little boys.
Because that's what you could do
on radio.
Yes. Yeah.
One of the other great things about this book is that it's clearly a mystery written for adults, but it is not self-consciously adult, and I put the word in quotes. You know, in that there is some profanity, there are allusions to sex.
Sure.
But the truth, my goodness, you'll find that in pretty much any 21st century novel, I should think.
Right, and that's just adult life.
That's just adult life.
Right.
But by and large, in terms of the story and the way it's structured and the way you've written it, there's 98% of what's in here could very easily have been presented in a movie, for instance, made in the 1930s.
Yeah.
But was
I don't know if it was a conscious decision on my part. I think I'm heavily influenced also by PBS mystery series.
Okay.
You know, Poirot and things
sure,
like that
Campion,
set in that time period. And I think that's what influenced that more than... Also, the movies of the period, obviously. Mm-hmm. You know, the 30s, they had the production code where they could only do certain things. They couldn't, you know... They had to kiss with their mouths closed. And
right, and of course...
really painful looking, right?
If two people are on the bed, one foot has to be on the floor.
Yes.
That's the notorious
one.
And
the separate beds.
Of course,
for married people. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I ask you a little bit about the craft of a story like this, because I often hear from mystery writers who talk about when you're writing something like this, a whodunit sort of story, very often you start with your conclusion and then work your way backwards to put together elements that lead to that conclusion. Was that, did it work that way for you, or was there some other approach?
With The Darkness Knows, it was started out as a NaNoWriMo, or National Novel Writing book, which is, if you know anything about that, it's a bunch of crazy people that get together in the month of November every year, and they try to write a 50,000-word novel in the month of November.
Mm-hmm.
So, keeping that in mind, no, I didn't know who the killer was when I started writing it, which is really not how you should write a mystery. It's the really difficult way of writing a mystery. So, essentially, I had to, after that month, when I was rewriting, I had to figure out who I wanted the killer to be and then rewrite it to have it make sense.
Okay, so in a way, you put everything out there and then...
It was just like a brain dump, you know, the first draft.
Sure.
And then I figured out, yeah, this is how you do it.
Of course. So did it, forgive my asking this way maybe, but did it surprise you who the killer was? I mean, what was that moment of realization? And we're trying not to give away an ending here.
Right.
But
I was trying to find... a likely person who is the least likely, if that makes any sort of sense.
Sure.
And once you've figured out who you want your murderer to be, then you can go back and throw in all the red herrings along the way to make the reader think it's all the other people.
This person or
that
one. And it's funny because, yes, if you listen to radio shows and radio detectives in particular, they're especially good at that, and in a very... similar sort of framework, in that on a radio drama, half-hour drama, you may have a budget for 6 or 8 actors, mm-hmm. which means mm-hmm. once you get your detective and your police lieutenant
right.
out of, and your femme fatale, you know, that leaves you 3 or 4 people to choose from. And so, yeah, you have to be very conscious about who gets suspected and find that payoff at the right moment.
Right. And it's obviously a different genre, you know, writing for radio mm-hmm. as opposed to a novel in the way you go about structuring the story. So I think that's interesting to think about, mm-hmm. you know, how could it be adapted, the same story,
oh, yeah.
to another format like radio?
As it says in the book, The Darkness Knows is the first adventure featuring the characters of Vivian Witchell, the radio actress, and mm-hmm. Charlie Haverford, the detective. Mm-hmm. So, without giving too much away, can you tell us what's next for Vivian and Charlie?
Well, I was just doing the copy edits this morning on book 2.
Oh, wow.
It's written. Comes out next October. What's in store? Well, it was kind of up in the air at the end of book 1 about Vivian's career mm-hmm. and even her relationship with Charlie. And book 2 starts out, she is still with the station, still on The Darkness Knows. Her job has been saved by Graham, which is surprising, which mm-hmm. is a little surprising at the end. And Vivian starts to suspect something about her father, her deceased father, that she needs Charlie's help with digging into. So that's how they come back together in the second installment.
And one of the other great things about this book, in addition to being a terrific read from start to finish, on page 343, there is an acknowledgement of the Nostalgia Digest.
Yes, and absolutely. But
both of us, I think, have this in common in that Chuck Shaden was hugely influential in terms of our desire to learn more about this period.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, when you're writing a book that's based in a world that you have no firsthand knowledge of, mm-hmm. And there's really no one around anymore to ask. I mean, most of the people
are gone.
So it was invaluable to me to find those interviews that Chuck had done with the huge radio stars of the day and just ask them about their daily processes. You know, mm-hmm. what was it like to produce a show? You know, how did you get on this show? You know, because those are the things that aren't included in history books about radio. You know, you get the dry, the show was on from 1935 to 1939. You know, this was the director, the stars, but they don't tell you anything about how it was produced, you know, and that's what I really needed to know. So I found that really invaluable.
Yes, I think, and that's one of the things I think that really shows through in this, in the writing, is that, yeah, it's somebody who clearly understands the minutiae, you know, mm-hmm. the fact, I mean, again, not everyone who's not interested in this subject would need to know or would care to know, for instance, that when radio people did a live show, they did it for the East and the and the Midwest, and they'd have to do one 3 hours later for the West Coast.
Right.
And that actually plays an important role in the story.
Yes. Yeah, you know? And that's something I learned along the way. I didn't mm-hmm. know that starting out. Right. You know, it was like a light bulb went off for me. I'm like, oh, so that's why there might be 2 recordings of a suspense episode, because one was for the East Coast, one was for the West Coast.
I suppose it's unfair to ask this, since you've only finished the second book. Is this something you see taking you through the rest of your life as an author, or at least a finite but lengthy amount of time?
That's a good question. I have a contract for 3.
Okay.
So I'm writing the 3rd. That's what I know right now. But it's wide open. I mean, in the 3rd book, Vivian and Graham are supposed to be going to Hollywood to talk about moving the show to Hollywood.
Perfect.
So, I mean, it could go that direction. It can go to the movies. It could stay in Chicago. I mean, there are so many possibilities.
Absolutely. So. Well, the first book from author Cheryl Honigford, The Darkness Knows. It is available at all quality bookstores and, of course, online at sourcebooks.com. Cheryl, congratulations on a terrific debut, and thank you so much for being part of our podcast.
Well, thank you for having me.
Our conversation with author Cheryl Honigford, recorded at the global headquarters of Funny Valentine Press in November of 2016. We apologize for those occasional moments of sonic distortion, but we hope they did not interfere with your enjoyment of our conversation. Now, Cheryl's novel, The Darkness Knows, is set at a radio station in Chicago in 1938. Now, there were several detectives on radio at this time, but comparatively few female detectives. However, we are pleased to present one of those female detectives for you now. This is an episode from a syndicated series from the late 1930s called Philco Mysteries. It was sponsored by Philco, the radio manufacturer. And in an effort to make sure everyone got the point, the lead character was a detective named Phyllis Coe, or Phil Coe. She was played by actress Peggy Allenby. Joining her in support as friend Tom Taylor is a young man named Clayton Collier, who just a few years later would become perhaps the greatest superhero radio ever knew when he played the title role on The Adventures of Superman. Now, you will hear a few references in this particular show to the Philco Mystery Contests. This is because the Philco Mystery Program was actually very ambitious, in that in an effort to prompt the sale of Philco radios, listeners were invited to go to their Philco dealers and get the Philco Mystery Book, which would include, among other things, a contest form for each of the Philco Mystery Programs. Listeners would get to hear a complete mystery over the course of 15 minutes, but there would be something left out. Typically, it would be, as in this case, the clue that Phil Coe discovered that allowed her to solve the mystery. The idea was that if listeners had paid close attention, they would know what that clue was. They would write that down on the contest entry form and submit that in that week's contest. And then, of course, one lucky winner would be selected. So, while we can't offer you any prizes for guessing the clue, why don't you listen along and see if you can figure out what enabled Phil Coe to solve the mystery of the Death Ray Tube as we go back to the 1930s for Phil Coe Mysteries.
Phil Coe Mysteries on the air. The mystery of the Death Ray Tube, a new kind of radio contest. Mystery, thrills, suspense. Your chance to play detective. Your opportunity to win a huge weekly prize, maybe even a mammoth grand prize in this great $50,000 cash prize contest. Every week at this same time over this station, your Philco Radio Tube dealer presents transcribed Philco Radio Mysteries. Fascinating fun. $50,000 in cash for the winners. A contest of skill that you may win. Anybody can enter, nothing to buy. Read about all this in the big Philco Mystery Book, free at your Philco Radio Tube dealer store. You cannot win without this book. Get your copy. Contains official entry blanks, lists the prizes, tells you all the details, shows you all the rules. In a few seconds, Philco Radio Mystery Number 3 will begin. Have you got your Philco Mystery Book open to pages 8 and 9? Use the diagram on page 8 to help you as you listen. Take notes. Keep your ears open. Don't miss a word. Ready? Then listen. Philco, the beautiful girl detective, is going to solve a mystery. 126 people are going to win big cash prizes for telling how she solves it. Maybe you'll win. Here comes the mystery of the Death Ray Tube. In the mountains of Colorado, Phyllis Coe and her admirer, Tom Taylor, are sitting on a rail fence in front of a large cabin, talking and enjoying the morning sun. Tom seems a bit perplexed.
Phil, it seems to me that a few words of explanation are in order.
I refuse to explain a thing till you point that gun the other way.
All right. But I'm at least going to pop it a few tin cans.
If you fire that gun and waken old Dr. Crawford, he'll have you boiled in oil.
The old doc is certainly a mystery man. Come on, Phil, be a good girl and give me all the details, huh? Why are we out here, and what are old Dr. Crowfoot and his two assistants doing?
Well, Dr. Joseph Crowfoot and my father were great friends. Before Dad began devoting all his time to criminology, he and Dr. Crawford used to work together, experimenting with electricity. 3 days ago, I received a wire from the doctor asking me to fly out here. He said he'd concluded an experiment that he and Dad had often discussed, and he knew I'd be interested in hearing about it.
Well, that certainly doesn't clear it up very much. Hey, see that tin can over there by that wooden shed?
Oh, now, Tom, don't. Oh,
ha! Bullseye.
Now you've done it. Here comes Dr. Crawford, and he looks like a thundercloud.
Good heavens, man. Put that pistol back in the holster.
Oh, I'm sorry, Doctor. I was just taking a pot shot at that tin can there by the shed.
Yes. And inside that shed lies the culmination of all my years of infinitely patient work.
Oh, I'm sorry, Dr. Crawford.
Oh, I know, my dear, I know. Confound it. Just when I want to talk to you, here come those two crazy assistants of mine. Yes, Conrad, yes, Kent. What do you want?
Our laboratory assignment for the day, naturally.
Must I direct every step you take, Conrad? Start something of your own.
I already have, sir. New theory. Thank you for giving me a chance to get back to it. Coming, Conrad?
Yes, I'm coming. You and your fool theory.
That fellow Conrad gets under my skin.
Phyllis, this is going to be the greatest day of my life.
Oh, how do you mean, Dr. Crawford?
Well, today, for the first time, my scientific development will be demonstrated before eyes other than my own. A representative of the United States government will be here.
Oh, it sounds very interesting, Doctor.
Interesting? My dear, what lies inside that wooden shed is so interesting that the greatest brain in the War Department is coming here to investigate. I received a telegram from Washington this morning. Major William Osborne is arriving by train this afternoon.
The Major Osborne?
Yes, the Major Osborne.
What is this development of yours, Doctor? A poison gas?
Poison gas, huh? Nothing quite so elementary. But late this afternoon, when Major Osborne arrives, you will know what is in that shed. Well, Major Osborne, are you ready?
Yes, Doctor, quite.
Well, come then. Let's all get over to the shed.
My dear Mr. Taylor, if you'd been cooped up in Washington as I've been for the past 5 years, you'd really appreciate this country.
Now, here we are. Just let me unfasten this lock. There we are. Now step inside, please.
Thank you. After you, Miss Cole.
Oh, thank you.
And now, my friends, what do you see?
Well, I see a guinea pig in a cage.
The only thing out of the ordinary, Doctor, is that odd-looking glass cylinder resting on the bed of cotton.
Out of the ordinary, you say? See, now, my friends, this is a death ray tube.
A death ray?
But, Doctor, for years men have been trying to...
Of course, Major, of course. But it remained for me, Joseph Crowfoot, to discover the secret.
Dr. Crowfoot, if that glass tube really does produce a death-dealing ray, your invention will be the most dangerous weapon in the world.
Exactly. There will be enough energy stored within my death ray machine to destroy the entire race of man.
Does the model function, Doctor? Have you put it to the test?
Oh, yes, on small animals. Of course, you must realize that this is only a working model of the death ray machine I hope to build. Still, it has power enough to kill a man. My friends, the government in whose hands my machine is placed would be omnipotent.
Of course it would.
Dr. Crawford, assuming the efficiency of your invention, are you planning to turn it over to the United States government?
Yes.
Dr. Crawford, who else knows of your invention?
Well, my two assistants, of course.
Could they replace it?
They know nothing of its vast intricacies. They have merely helped me in general details of the construction. I am the only man living who can replace it.
May I have a look at the tube, Doctor?
Stay away from it. Don't touch it. Why, if it dropped only 2 feet, it would shatter and its energies be lost forever.
Is it simple to operate?
Yes, Major. You notice this platinum key at the base of the tube?
Yes, Doctor.
One turn of this key forms an electrical contact, releasing the lethal energy from the opposite end. One turn would snuff out life. The large machine, when completed, will be able to wipe out whole armies.
But, Doctor...
But for the present, we shall have to be content with this guinea pig. Now, don't worry, my dear. The ray is quick, deadly, and painless. Stand aside, please.
Stand here, Phil.
Ready now? I turn the platinum key.
Oh. Dr. Crawford, I congratulate you.
What will the government say to that, Major Osborne?
The answer is obvious, my dear sir. You have succeeded.
But now it's growing dark. In the morning, we shall have a further demonstration. Come, everybody. It's time for dinner. You know, we go to bed early in the mountains.
Everybody, wake up! Fire!
Tom, where is it?
Down in the wooden shed.
Good heavens, the doctor's too. Doctor, are you up?
Yes, Major. Oh, good Lord. Come on, help me.
Where are you, Doctor?
The shed is burning. Hurry, Kent. Hurry, Conrad. The shed is burning.
What time is it, Tom?
After midnight. Look out, Dolly. Don't stumble over that bush.
Follow me, Miss Coe. I'll pick the way for you.
Oh, I can see now, Major. The flames are pretty high.
Doctor, don't go in there. Don't. Conrad, he's gone in.
You better come out, Doc. It's pretty hot in there.
Dr. Crowfoot, come out.
Here he comes. Oh, thank goodness.
Are you all right, Doctor?
It's gone.
What?
My tube is gone.
Doctor, are you sure?
Yes. Here is the box of cotton, but my tube has disappeared. Someone has stolen my death ray.
Oh.
Look, the fire's died out suddenly.
Yes, yes. Do you think I've not installed protection? An automatic carbon dioxide extinguisher. But my tube is gone. It's gone. Which of you has it? Who is the thief?
Just a moment, Doctor. I found something.
My tube? Quickly, is it my tube?
No, a rag soaked in kerosene.
Then this fire was set deliberately.
Yes, apparently by someone who didn't know about your extinguisher.
Well, that could be any one of you. Nobody knew of that automatic system but myself. Who is the thief? Which one of you?
Oh, now, please be calm, Doctor, and let's go at this quietly. Come, everybody. I think we'd better all get back to the large cabin.
You want me, Miss Cole?
Yes, Mr. Kent. And you too, Mr. Conrad.
Don't worry, little lady. I'm tagging along.
Ah, boy, I wish I'd had time to put on my slippers. Can't say I like this barefoot boy business.
Hurry up, Phyllis. Now, you're a detective. Find the thief.
I'll do my best, Dr. Crowfoot. But you must be calm.
Well, here's the cabin. Come on, get inside. Get inside, all of you. Come on. Don't anybody try to sneak away.
All right. Let's all gather right inside the door. Light that kerosene lamp, Mr. Kent.
Okay, Miss Cole.
Ouch! Oh, holy Moses.
What is it, Tom?
Ah, I stepped on something hot. What in the world? Hold that lamp over, will you? Ah, now I see what it is. Here you are, Major Osborne. It's your pipe.
I'm so sorry, Mr. Taylor. I probably dropped it in all that excitement.
Yes, and the ashes fell out. They're still glowing.
Well, come on. Who has my tube? Hand it over.
No, wait a moment, Doctor. Now, everyone in this room and everyone in the world would have a motive for stealing Dr. Crowfoot's glass tube. It means power. The person who opened that shed and took the tube started the fire as a blind. He hoped everything would be consumed so that we'd think the tube had also been destroyed.
Remarkable.
Oh, you shut up, Conrad. Go ahead, Phyllis.
Excuse me, Miss Coe, but I notice that Mr. Taylor is suffering from his burned foot.
Yeah, that's right, Major Osborne. It hurts pretty much.
I have some ointment on the dresser in my room. Why don't you go in and use it?
Well, thanks, I will. Give me a match, will you, Kent?
You won't need it, Taylor. I left the candle burning in there.
Oh. All right, Major, thanks. I'll be right back as soon as I put some stuff on my foot.
Come, Phyllis, hurry. Don't waste any more time.
All right, Doctor. Now, according to the French law, a man is guilty until proven innocent. I think that's the way we'd better proceed.
The French method works pretty well, too. I had occasion to study it in action last winter in Paris.
Oh. And now, Mr. Kent, where were you when the alarm was given?
Well, next door in my cabin. I was sound asleep.
You share the cabin with Mr. Kent, don't you, Mr. Conrad?
Yes, and I can assure you I was asleep, too.
And you, Major?
I was in a deep sleep. I'd had a long journey, you remember.
And you didn't awaken until Tom shouted?
That's correct. Somehow, in the pitch dark, I found my slippers and dressing gown and dashed from my room.
Oh, come now. This is all foolishness. We're not getting anywhere.
On the contrary, Dr. Crowfoot. I know who stole your tube.
You? Who? Who is he?
This gentleman was also stolen the real Major Osborne's credentials.
Oh, what?
The Major?
Say, are you sure?
Stay where you are. Every one of you.
The tube, look. It's in his hand.
Yes, Doctor. It fits very nicely into the pocket of a dressing gown. Miss Coe, I congratulate you upon your cleverness. As a matter of fact, you are far too clever.
For heaven's sake, don't drop my tube.
No fear of that. I've traveled halfway around the world to obtain this weapon. It seems that my government had an interest in it also.
What are you going to do?
There is only one thing I can do, with all of you. To borrow the expression of Dr. Crowfoot, the ray will be quick, deadly, and painless.
You can't do this. It's my life's work. Here, give it to me.
Doctor, come back.
The doctor, you...
You see? It really works on larger game than guinea pigs. And now, let's make it short. Ladies first, as usual.
Tom!
Good shot, Taylor.
I'll say. I came back just in time.
Look, the platinum key is still in his right hand.
And the tube is smashed to bits.
Poor old Dr. Crowfoot. If only I'd come a minute sooner.
Oh, Tom, do you know, somehow I'm glad you didn't.
It's a good thing Tom Taylor came in just then, I say. Major Osborne was an ugly customer. He fooled everybody but Phil Coe, the girl detective. Did he fool you? Why did Phil Coe suspect Major Osborne? You ought to be able to tell why. You heard everything that happened. Of course, you can give three reasons which enabled Phil to discover the guilty person. Enter the Philco Radio Mystery Contest. $50,000 in cash prizes for the winners. Huge weekly prizes, gigantic grand prizes. You probably have learned all about it in your free Philco Mystery book, which your Philco Radio tube dealer gave you without any obligation. Read the list of prizes again. Read the rules again. Be sure to write your answer on the official contest blank contained in the book. Remember, you must use this official entry blank for your answer, and you can't get the official entry blank without the book. So get your free copy now. This is a contest of skill. Your skill may win for you. Names of the major winners in this week's contest will be broadcast as soon as possible on a following Philco Radio Mystery program. Listen for Philco Radio Mysteries every week at this same time over this same station. Listeners with Philco radio tubes in their sets are going to have an advantage. Did you stop to think of that? In this contest, you will need to get good reception so that you won't miss anything that is done or said. And the best reception is what you get with Philco radio tubes. Next week, another Philco radio mystery. Next week, Philco, the girl detective, is going to find the guilty person in the thrilling airplane drama, Murder in the Sky. Next week, another opportunity to win your share of $50,000 in cash prizes.
That's the third program in the series Philco Mysteries, a syndicated show heard originally in the 1930s with Peggy Allenby in the role of Phil Coe and Clayton Collier in the role of Tom Taylor before he became Clark Kent. Did you figure out what Phil Coe figured out that allowed her to solve that mystery? Nowadays, I suppose a company would simply ask you to text them with your entry. But back then, in the 1930s, you know, you went to your Philco dealer, you got the Philco mystery book, and you pulled out the contest entry form for week number three. It's the fifth anniversary edition of the Nostalgia Digest podcast, and we're looking back at the golden age of radio, but also looking back at the first 5 years of the Nostalgia Digest podcast. During the 5 years of this podcast, we've gotten to say hello to some wonderful and talented people. We've also had to say goodbye to some wonderful and talented people, including Bob Elliott, who for more than 40 years was one half of the team of Bob and Ray. I first had occasion to interview Bob Elliott in 2005, during my first year as publisher of the Nostalgia Digest. Several years later, after becoming the host of Those Were the Days, I had occasion to journey to Bob's home in Maine and record a conversation for our radio show. And then in 2013, author David Pollack wrote a terrific biography of Bob and Ray called Bob and Ray, Keener Than Most Persons. And in hopes of spreading the word about this wonderful book, about this groundbreaking comedy duo, we arranged a conversation with Bob Elliott that was presented on the June 2013 edition of the Nostalgia Digest podcast. In addition to talking about the book and the radio work of Bob and Ray, we also talked about the people who influenced and the people who worked with Bob and Ray. Something that David Pollack did an excellent job with was placing Bob and Ray, I think, in the context of radio history. This book may be the last word on your work, but it might also be the last word on the work of people like Ray Knight, who otherwise would really literally be lost to the sands of time.
Yeah, he deserved a book somewhere back then. And I always was afraid that this book was a little bit late coming up, but what could we do? But Ray had a very colorful career and certainly was, if not the first, he was one of the first three comedy writer actors who made it on radio. His show called The Cuckoo Hour was on every Saturday night, and the characters he created were very much similar to some that we created. Like, he did a lot of voices himself, and in ways it was close to what we did. And when we got to New York and found we needed writing help, turning out as much stuff as we were using, the NBC called on him, and he had been doing a morning show in New York up to a few years before that, before we got down there, and got him with us, and he worked out beautifully. But even for a longer time, Tom Cook had been writing material for the NBC Weekend Monitor show, which we were on for 7 or 8 years, and he had a great sense of humor. We never met him then, but through the producer who did know him, he said, would you like to see some of Tom's comedy bits that he can write? And we said, sure. And I think he was living in St. Louis at the time and mailing stuff in to Monitor, and later, right after that, to us, because we liked his stuff immediately. He created a lot of things that we get credit for that he really created. We brought them to life, I think. But some of the funniest things that we did over the years and repeated were written by Tom Cook, and he needs the recognition for all he contributed to us. And we've never denied it. We started when we've been asked that question a lot of times. Why didn't you mention that the show was written by Tom Cook? You didn't say that on many shows at the end. I think Benny did, and Fred Allen never did, I remember. And we never thought of putting a writing credit on, and Ray Knight didn't want a writing credit for various reasons, so we never got into that habit. But I think today it should be Tom Cook should get the applause for what he
absolutely for. Absolutely. Well, Tom did a number of things over your entire career, even
yes,
into the 1980s.
And we only did meet him in person maybe four times, and I think that's overstating it. He was up here in Maine one summer, and he and his wife stopped by, and we had a nice afternoon looking out over Casco Bay, but that's the closest that I'd ever been to him.
An excerpt from a conversation with Bob and Ray's Bob Elliott, which was featured on the June 2013 edition of the Nostalgia Digest podcast. That podcast is part of the Nostalgia Digest Podcast 2013 CD, containing a dozen MP3 files for just $9.95 plus tax and shipping. Information about the Nostalgia Digest Podcast on CD is available at nostalgiadigest.com. Nostalgiadigest.com is also the home of the Nostalgia Shop, where you can find David Pollack's book, Bob and Ray, Keener Than Most Persons. You'll find that and a lot more when you visit the Nostalgia Shop at nostalgiadigest.com. We're pleased to look back on the 5-year history of the Nostalgia Digest podcast, but as we celebrate our 5th anniversary, we're also pleased for the chance to share the microphone with some very talented people who have used their own affection for entertainment of the past in creating art of the present. And in that regard, it's a real pleasure to bring to the microphone the husband and wife team of musician Chris Leegan and cartoonist Heather McAdams. As a songwriter, Chris Leegan appears to be capable of writing about practically anything. Drawing from multiple musical genres, his songs cover a wide emotional terrain, going from the sweet to the soulful, from the sorrowful to the silly. And sometimes within the course of a single song. Here's an example of one such song from his latest CD, Out of the Can, a few moments of Chris Leegan's The World Missed Out.
baby boy. Favorite toy, that piece of Hot Wheel track I chewed. I was a Hot Wheel track chewing little dude. But the world missed out. The world missed out. The world missed out on me. Little party I threw downstairs. Guess I'll fold up all these empty chairs. And the world missed out. The world missed out. The world missed out.
A few moments of The World Missed Out, written and recorded by Chris Legan for his 2016 album, Out of the Can. Most of the 10 CDs that Chris has recorded have been low-key, homemade affairs, available only through the live performances, which he shares the stage with his wife, cartoonist and filmmaker Heather McAdams. Heather McAdams has been a fixture in the Chicago art scene for 3 decades. For many years, she was a contributor to the Chicago Reader. More recently, her country calendars have allowed her to honor legendary figures from the golden age of country music. Over the years, Heather has also accumulated a remarkable collection of 16mm films, ranging from old movie trailers to outdated toy commercials to vintage soundies. The year 2016 has been a busy one for Chris Legan and Heather McAdams, as Heather puts the finishing touches on her 2017 Everything Including Country calendar, and the Flat Five, a magnificent Chicago band that includes Chris's younger brother Scott, recently recorded a dozen of Chris's songs for their debut CD, It's a World of Love and Hope. We sat down with Chris Legan and Heather McAdams to talk about their interest in the past and how they channeled that interest into their work in the present. I started by asking Chris if he had in fact been writing songs for his entire life.
Now that I'm older, it's a good portion of my life. I'd say probably around 19 I started writing music.
Okay. One of the things I love about your songs, and that includes the new album Out of the Can, but all the ones I've seen and when I've seen you perform is... As a songwriter, you seem utterly fearless.
Yeah.
You know, you've written beautiful, haunting songs like The Great State of Texas, about a man on death row.
Mm-hmm.
But you've also written some seriously goofy songs, mm-hmm. which I love, you know, Bug Light or Frankenstein Just Got Up, mm-hmm. which don't really have any agenda, it seems to me, other than to be entertaining. And then there are songs like I Could Fall in Love with You, which are very sweet in sort of an off-kilter way. It seems to me like you don't really feel there's anything you couldn't write about. Is that a fair guess?
Yeah. I respond to freedom, you know? I really do. I very seldom write for an audience. Mm-hmm. You know, I write for myself, first and foremost. I mean, I think about the reaction Heather might have, or my brother Scott might have, just because I respect them so much. Mm-hmm. But... when I'm writing stuff, I just kind of am moved generally first and foremost by a melody. For me, I mean, different people write music different ways, and I'm not saying that I haven't started with a lyric first and gone with that, but generally it's a chord on the piano that I feel like I want to hear a lot in the next few weeks. You know, that allows me to stay with that and not get bored with it. And then lyrically, I just kind of let my mind flow, you know, without restrictions. Heather and I both are fans of the Jack Benny Show.
Perfect.
And what we always respond to is the way his show is laid out, he can do anything. Mm-hmm. He can do anything.
He can go anywhere.
He can go anywhere. It can be some, it could be a dream. And therefore, it can be a kind of a fantasy thing. But the writers on that show were so free, and they knew that the audience would accept anything Benny did, that you could go into fantasy stuff, or you could go with a straight-ahead variety thing where he introduces Bobby Darin to come out.
Mm-hmm.
So I think the freedom aspect is always the driving force. I've never personally been very successful, and I haven't even attempted it that often to work for hire. Sometimes someone will give me a project to do, and it's, you know, I've had various levels of success doing it, just because I, you know, it's
I think you're really good at that, though. When Randy asked you to do that opening for his DJ show in Wisconsin, you did that Randy in the Morning. That was hilarious. And then you did the Pumpkin song for Jake Austin. And you work well under
assignment. I guess, well, you know, she says that. I guess it just, for my own personal self, it's not as pleasing or fun for me. It's a little more stress. So I kind of like to avoid stress, you know.
It's wonderful to hear that you're fans of Jack Benny, because you're absolutely right. The writing on the Benny program was brilliant. And you make a good point, which was, Benny had trust in his audience, and after a time together, he realized the audience could kind of, you know, they knew him well enough to trust him in whatever flights of fancy he might take. And,
yeah.
You know, so, I mean, it sounds like you have a similar trust in whatever audience you're performing to, in the sense that you're going to be, all of you will be fine with me if I write a love song or if I write a song about Frankenstein.
Yeah. Well, I guess, you know, I am fortunate to have my favorite artist as my wife, and my favorite musician as my brother, and my family in general are, like, just fantastic support, you know, for me, and are very funny and everything. And so I guess, you know, I may say that I write for myself, but I do write for a handful of people additionally. And the people that I do think of, I really trust as audience. So
you know, one thing that he does, if I can make a comment, is it, within a song that has a kind of a more serious, you know, bringing out that kind of feeling, and then he'll throw some zinger in there that's just hilariously funny. And that kind of is confusing, I think, even though people can't hold themselves back. For example, in Birmingham, when he says, you know, I don't know the exact words, it's like, you know, we pulled off the road so you could pee, and I stood guard while, you know, what's the next line?
So no one else could see.
So no one else could see. But, you know, people are listening to the song with great, you know, seriousness, and then all of a sudden they hear that. Or in Mexican Wedding, which is even more a serious song,
when
he says about watering their asses. Can you say ass?
Well, you're referring to donkeys in this case, right?
Yeah. But,
it's
when
the internet.
He throws that out, you just can't help but just...
No, you know, and whenever I do that song, and then they water their asses, it's just like there's snickering. You know, adults in the audience still snickering, you know, after all these years.
I think Morrissey actually once said that he would never write a love song without an escape clause in the third verse.
Yeah.
What Heather's referring to is not quite that, not the sense of let's directly undercut everything I've said up to now. But the line in Birmingham to which she refers, I mean, it's amusing, but it's also, my God, if you wanted a snapshot of devotion, that's a perfect one.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
I'm thinking that... in the course of this, we might break away and hear a song or two of yours. And since we've just discussed Mexican Wedding off the new album, maybe you can you tell me something about what inspired that?
I think that I, you know, of course, it was sitting at the piano and just playing a couple of chords, and then something sounded a little Latin about it. Mm-hmm. And so I wanted to write something that was sweet, but also I think there's references to the drug issue that is happening in Mexico with El Chapo and those kind of things, you know.
Okay.
So I wanted to, I don't know, really. I don't really recall why I wrote that song.
God, I don't see that song as being sweet. I think it's scary as heck.
Well, it begins sweet, you know.
Sure,
it was a Mexican wedding.
Wedding, yeah.
100 friends, maybe more, you know, and it's very sweet and stuff. And then I added sound effects to it, you know, which is my favorite escape clause. I always figure if you can't write a really good song all the way through, just start adding on them sound effects, you know.
Which you have a lot of in your collection.
We got a big collection of sound effects records, you know.
I will keep that in mind in case someone swears accidentally.
Yeah.
Oh, well, let's hear from out of the can, and I'm holding it up to, what, camera two? Yes. From out of the can, Chris Ligon and Mexican Wedding.
Tiny sombrero
tied to his head with a string. Somebody bust my heart, I seek my revenge. I give them both a head start, then I stick him with my syringe. I stick them both with my syringe. I'll meet you both in the deep end. I'll meet you both in the pool.
Chris Leegan and the song Mexican Wedding from his latest CD entitled Out of the Can. Chris, do you remember the first song you wrote? You mentioned you were about 19, but I wonder if you have a specific memory of that.
Well, originally, you know, I wrote songs on a little reel-to-reel recorder, a little two-track, that I couldn't monitor the first track while I recorded on the second, so it was a pot shot that you had to do over and over again. And maybe it sunk up.
So maybe you double-tracked yourself and maybe you...
Yeah, exactly.
Man.
And some of the first songs I wrote were, Well, Poop Ghost was a really early song that employed my brother Scott at age 10 and my sister Jill. My sister Jill was homesick from school that day, I believe. Scott was sick home from school. It was just us three at the piano. And it ended up being a 30-minute, basically, abuse session where I was trying to get this song with them singing harmony. Began laughing after 10 or 15 attempts at this song, and I was getting irritated, and it went on like that for about several hours, to where I couldn't get set the song I wanted, and Scott and Jill were becoming more and more just delirious with the lyrics, and then the fact that I wasn't happy with their performances.
But it all culminates in the quintessential performance, and it's pretty funny to listen to, really. The Poop Ghost Sessions.
Yes.
So you got your Let It Be out of the way early then.
Yeah, exactly.
Now then, I Saw a Rat. You wrote that early, right?
I Saw a Rat was a song I wrote.
Yeah. Who were some of the people that inspired you to think, this is something I could do, this is something I should do?
Well, I grew up listening to my dad play the piano. My dad, Dick Leegan, was a really good jazz piano player, and he taught me how to play the piano by ear. Neither him nor myself reads music. Mm-hmm. And then when I got into college, I started hearing a lot of music from people I had never heard of, people like Captain Beefheart. Mm-hmm. Tom Waits, really interesting songwriters, and I started getting interested in people like Hoagy Carmichael and people that were, real songwriters, I don't know whether that I feel like in my life I'm influenced by thousands and thousands of people, and I hear it in my own stuff. I hear direct references to, in fact, near direct rip-offs from people. But, there are only so many notes in the musical scale. Mm-hmm. And so, in as much as there have been, trials and lawsuits against various people for copyright infringement, I feel generally when I make a reference to some other song, It's a good-natured thing, and it is never in the form of a rip-off. It's more like an homage. And so I do hear a lot of various people,
Mm-hmm. Well, I know Ringo Starr talked about when he was with the Beatles that he'd try to write songs, he'd bring them in, and the other three members of the group would just be in hysterics because they would more or less told him, oh, that song was great when it was known as this song. that he would really just, he'd finally put new lyrics to a melody he'd heard on the radio. But, I mean, you've never done that. It's not like, what you've done, you've absorbed influences.
It's not as though
you've tried to be the Beatles any more than you've tried to be, you know,
yeah,
Lord Buckley or
yeah,
whomever.
Right.
And in fact, I met your mother a few weeks ago.
Uh-huh.
Lovely woman.
Yeah.
And she told me about the time that you were telling her about a songwriter named Wild Man Fisher.
Oh, yeah. Wild Man Fisher.
And, I mean, a fascinating character. But I just think, you know, that says a lot because a lot of us don't have mothers, as much as we may love our mothers,
yeah,
we don't have mothers to whom we could automatically turn them on to Wild Man Fisher.
Yeah, and so and who would most likely like it.
Yes, who would, well, who would understand where it was coming
yeah,
from.
Yeah.
He's got the hippest mother known to man.
I believe it.
Yeah.
Known to mothers. She's unbelievable
yeah,
what she knows and what she likes and the presents that she gives you on your birthday are tailor-made for exactly what you're obsessed with. You know?
Are there any current songwriters, local or national or international, whose work you follow and absorb? I mean, I know you have a great affection for songwriters and performers from the past,
mm-hmm,
but I'd be curious to know if that extends to any from the present.
Well, I think that Scott's group, NRBQ,
mm-hmm,
I think that Scott and Terry, you know, started to co-write some stuff, and then I've long admired Terry Adams' work as a pop and rock and roll songwriter. I think, you know, he writes some of the really great songs.
Mm-hmm.
But like you said, I find that because there is 100 years of recorded history at your disposal in every Salvation Army, you walk in, you can, for 50 cents, you know, for $10, you can walk out and you can listen to records for a week.
That's true.
And there is so much recorded stuff that's been here forever that I find that I'm still learning and I see new records every day that I've never seen in my life.
Well, we went and saw Nick Lowe and we were blown away by him, and he was blown away by your music too, so he's somebody, right?
Yeah, I really like Nick Lowe. But there's thousands of people. But,
well, of course.
You know,
you don't appear to be musical snobs about it either, in the sense that, I mean, you talk about going to the Salvation Army, and I know some people who go thinking, geez, if I don't find this or this, forget it. But, I mean, it seems like if you find something, you know, of an international bent, if you find something of a jazz or classical bent, you're still willing to pick it up and try it and absorb it.
Yeah, and then that's
if
the...
If it's under a dollar.
Well, that's the benefit of that, you know, and that's why I've always said that that's the best way you can get a musical education is garage sales and junk stores, mm-hmm, and stuff like that. Whereas now, you know, if you go to a record store, it's $25 for one record, and you better like it because that's
exactly
a lot of money, you know?
Indeed. And you were talking about your brother, Scott Legan,
yeah,
that he plays with NRBQ, a terrific band. He also plays with a group here in Chicago called the Flat Five,
yes,
whose work we've enjoyed for many years. They have recorded an album this year called It's a World of Love and Hope, and it consists entirely of songs you wrote.
That's right, yes.
How did you... When did you learn that this was going to be a tribute album to Chris Legan?
Well, they had been doing a couple of my songs years ago, you know, at the beginning of their existence. And I think that they wanted to, you know, based on the demand of their fans, and they've got a really good fan base,
mm-hmm,
they wanted to put out a record. And because they had done a few of my songs, they felt like it was kind of a natural way to put out a record, and it made sense, as opposed to trying to get rights from all the various covers they also do.
Sure.
They do standard songs, and they do, you know.
No, they do Beach Boys songs.
Yeah,
they do a great version of Count Basie's Little Darling.
They do lots of great stuff. So, and legally, I think that presents a little bit of an issue with someone trying to record a record. So, as talented as the Flat Five are, and Scott does write music occasionally, but that's not really what he does. Scott is a fantastic musician and my favorite musician, but he's not really a songwriter, so it was not
he's
him.
He's really good at writing.
Oh, I know. His songs are fantastic.
But he doesn't do it like as much as you.
But he didn't. It's not like they had 13 Scott Legan songs,
right,
they
sure
wanted to record. And so it's not, I did not write music for this album.
Right.
This was all, for the most part, I wrote a couple of them late, as with them in mind, actually. They thought that would make a nice record. It would make sense for them to do. There was pretty much to choose from. So I sent them a CD with, you know, maybe 30 songs, and they kind of threw things around, and they recorded maybe 15 or 16, knowing that they could discard a couple, you know.
Or save them for the re-release.
Yeah, right.
20 years from now.
Or save them for something else, yeah.
Loaded question when you're talking about somebody else's album. Are there favorite performances of yours on the Love and Hope album?
Oh, yeah, yeah. I mean, I love the whole record.
Sure, it is a beautiful record.
It's fantastic. I think some of my personal favorites, I think their take on Bug Light is really amazing.
Yes, I always that put me in mind of the Fairfield Four.
Yeah, right. It's a total. You know, I think that they referred to it as a kind of a Mills Brothers approach to it.
Singer.
Yeah, very gospel.
Well, Kelly
yeah,
had a basically. Dream that she had that they had done Bug Light as the Mills Brothers. That's the story.
Oh, okay.
So yeah, and upon hearing that, now she had this dream about the Mills Brothers. Just like a day before they went into the studio. Oh, and so when Scott heard that, he put together a very Mills Brothers, or like you said, with a very gospel-ish type thing with just five voices crowded around a microphone and a single guitar. Mm-hmm. And he worked on that arrangement that night, and the next day they went into the studio and recorded it. So... that is definitely one of my favorites. I like that the This Is Your Night, I think, is fantastic. Birmingham is just kills me, you know. I think Nora O'Connor's version of that, singing that, is really touching. And I mean, I like it all, you know. Hogan singing on You're Still Joe.
Bottom Buck is really great.
Bottom Buck.
Bottom Buck. Scott well, doing Bottom Buck.
It helps that they have great material. But if we were to, for instance, is there one you'd like the audience to hear right now?
Yeah, well, I would love to hear Birmingham.
Well, let's do it. The Flat Five singing Chris Legan's Birmingham.
Got a life here
I lived in Birmingham once.
Is that right?
The hottest place I ever lived. I thought St. Louis was bad, and we both lived in St. Louis, which is hot as blazes. But Birmingham made St. Louis look like Duluth. Really. Trying to mow lawn in Birmingham is really an undertaking.
Well, the Flat Five album, It's a World of Love and Hope, consists entirely of compositions written by Chris Legan. We know information about that is available online at theflat5chicago.com. We should also point out that for those who would like to learn more about Chris Legan's music and his various albums, and you've released, gosh, almost a dozen now, have you not?
Throughout the years, they've kind of come and gone in availability.
We know there are at least three that are currently in print.
Yeah, there are three that I can put in a mailbox right now.
But for those who are interested in learning more about Chris's music, the best way to do it, outside of seeing him perform, which is highly recommended, is to email him at Chris Legan, and that's LIGON. ChrisLegan@hotmail.com. Heather McAdams, you have a musical connection as well, in that you've worked with different artists as an artist. You've contributed the cover to an album called The Very Best of Robbie Fulks, featuring a songwriter whom we have featured on our show in the past. And you, the two of you, have worked together as performers and on the various film jamborees for which you've become famous in Chicago. And for close to two decades, you've produced a calendar every year, which began, I believe, as the Country Calendar. Is that right?
Well, it actually began when I lived in Kentucky as just a calendar with my cartoons featured on the months. And then a little later, I started to just do country musicians. Mm-hmm. And then it evolved into a live show. And I've kept it as the Country Calendar until a few years ago, where we blasted out of that format and called it the Everything But Country Calendar Show. And this year it's the Everything Plus Country Calendar Show.
Right. And for those who may not have seen these calendars, they are, I mean, obviously 12 pages are your standard calendar, as drawn by Heather McAdams, but also including some of her terrific artwork illustrating what I guess we would call musical heroes. Is that a safe bet?
Sometimes they may not be my biggest. They may not be my biggest hero, but I have a film of them in the show. I want to feature a person doing a couple songs by the featured musicians I draw, and then afterward we pull the screen down and we project 16 millimeter of the real deal. So somebody does Burl Ives, and then we pull the screen down, you get to see Burl Ives, and his head is bigger than yours. And then the screen goes up, and a new band is set up. Mm-hmm. And we go through the 12 acts like that. And people seem to really enjoy that as a show format.
Excellent.
Did
yes.
I answer your question?
I know, actually, I think that Heather, as opposed to necessarily being her heroes, I think a lot of the people featured in her calendar are people that she's interested in learning about herself.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say. I was going to say I didn't get enough of junior high school writing my little oral written reports on people. That's basically what I do, is I get to really research some of the people that we've bought films of and then share that, because I write a bio and then I have... I get to learn about them myself, and then the next thing I know, I'm looking for records by them, and it keeps me from being closed-minded, and it keeps me open to learning new things about people maybe I didn't think I really would like.
It's almost like putting herself through a little course, a little class. You know, she works on the calendar for around 3 months, usually starts in August.
2 months.
And then starts doing research, and whereas Burl Ives may not come to mind as being one of your musical heroes, once you start digging into somebody and looking beyond what you've heard on the radio and reading about them, suddenly you start thinking, man, this guy's really interesting. And then our show that we do, we further try to convey that to the audience and kind of educate people and give them a little bit of insight into people that, like we said, aren't necessarily our heroes, but somebody that we've found interesting enough to to...
Like, we found these films of Eddie Peabody, the banjo wizard.
Sure.
And so the next, and we thought, we got to show these. So suddenly I'm drawing Eddie Peabody. So it works like that. It's not like I say, oh, I really want to feature J.J. Cale. I can't find any film of J.J. Cale, you know. So, and it's all 16mm projected. But when we showed the Eddie Peabody films, I mean, those were the best films we showed.
Yeah, got fantastic audience
and
reaction.
And a lot of people maybe don't know who Eddie Peabody
is. Or you've seen his records, and not all record recorded stuff doesn't always convey what a person is truly about. Mm-hmm. If you see Eddie Peabody on film from the 30s or 40s, I promise you 100% of the audience is going to be knocked out by it. Mm-hmm. But if you pick up one of his Decca records from 1965 and he's doing... Oh. Ain't She Sweet in some corny little arrangement, it's not necessarily the full Eddie Peabody people need to know about.
The full Eddie Peabody experience.
Yeah.
But when you get the original 16mm films and you've got that light coming out of that projector and it's 8 foot on a screen, it looks... People really respond to that. Mm-hmm. It's a lot different than looking at it on a YouTube, you know. So this is part of what I like to keep alive is the whole 16mm projection. You know, people talk about things technologically that I don't even know what they're talking about because I'm all worried about the fact that my, you know, that my Frankie Lane film I just bought on eBay has vinegar syndrome, you know, but they don't know what that is, you know. And,
That's similar to what's the thing happens when you get a bug or a computer virus.
Oh, dear, okay.
Yeah. Vinegar syndrome is 70 years ago would have been referred to as a virus.
Yeah, basically it gives other films the same vinegar syndrome and they have to be thrown out or salad dressing has to be made out of. No, but anyway, I'm just telling you that I'm from like a throwback and I'm proud of it.
Indeed. Well, and that's one of the things I think that maybe is why we've known each other for as long as we have, and we have that in common, which is this affection for entertainment and perhaps for formats of entertainment that to large portions of the world might seem archaic. But of course, I think in our respective cases as well, there's a great affection for the entertainment of the past. And you both said something that I think is very important, which is an interest in learning about it.
Yeah.
You know, which not everyone of our age group or subsequent generations possesses that interest. And that's not a criticism. It just means it hasn't crossed their particular radar. But clearly, you know, these performers from the 30s and 40s and 50s, comedians and musicians, they clearly resonate with you.
It's like a treasure hunt. Mm-hmm. Like one time we were about to drive across the Chesapeake Bay Bridge going to the Eastern Shore, and we went to a Goodwill and picked up an Oney Wheeler CD, put it in the car, and never stopped listening to it. Every single song was incredible. The next thing you know, you're researching Oney Wheeler. You find out that he died on the stage of the Opry. He did, you know, mother songs that are as good as any gospel mother songs. He did, you know, honky tonk. And it's just fun. So you give it legs. You say, I've decided that this is, you know, and then you find out that he's not very well known. He's totally underrated. And there's so many people that are overrated that are getting so much attention that there's this movement going backwards that's equal in intensity to all the nonsense that's going forward. And I just think that there are people like us that we just are on, you know, we just can't. But you have to have the patience, you know. You've got to put in the time, and that's what's fun. It's not hard. It's, you know, it's like not always.
I think that we also have a reverence for the technology of the past, a 16mm projector that we're using at a show in 3 weeks that's 70 years old.
Wow. Yeah.
You know, the craftsmanship of that is so impressive. Similar to the craftsmanship of the Nicholas brothers doing this incredible dance 70 years ago. Or, looking at the way baseball was played 70 years ago with such grit and heart and love with not very much money involved, you know. I think that the whole thing about nostalgia isn't necessarily just a longing to live some other time. It's a reverence for what man has created, the good things that man has created. A record player that was built so well in 1953 that I can use it right now. I'm so much more impressed with that than cell phones or any kind of these new gadgets that are just throwaway world and just they come and they're gone next week and something else has to replace it. You know, the computer world is just so it's not built for the duration. You know, it's built to make $400 off of you now, and it's designed that 3 years from now you have to sink another $400 and buy another one. You know, we're both really interested. Heather makes films, and she still edits films at a little table looking through a viewer with a light in it, in film, a physical thing, not some magical thing like a DVD that who could ever figure out how that works? But film, you can see light going through a movie and see it projected, and so there's something very sensual about that.
Well, see, I always like cutting and pasting film. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, making splices.
Sure.
And then immediately you have a juxtaposition of two images that have never seen each other, and then you get into the sound. That was my favorite thing, but ever since I was a kid, I liked drawing with materials or scratching in the sand with a stick or having crayons and pens and pasting things up. And now suddenly they're telling me that I'm supposed to do this on a computer, and it doesn't interest me in the least. And it's hard because... it's not hard because I still get to do what I want to do except for the film. Kodak took all the print stocks away, so I can't really make films. But I can project them, and I can still make montages and mess around with it. But I'm just sort of glad that I'm the age I'm at and I'm not being born right now. Sorry, all the kids that are being born right now.
And, of course, in as we were saying earlier, Chris, taking, you know, a little Latin music influence here and a little jazz influence here, and suddenly you have a new song.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I one thing I haven't asked you about, but I should, is I know you're both fans of the Golden Age of Radio as well.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Do you have... this is one of those questions people ask me and I can never answer properly. Do you have a favorite show?
I do. Well, I think Suspense for drama. Mm-hmm. Suspense. And I think Jack Benny for the comedies. I think they're great. I'm not a big Gildersleeve fan.
I have Cinnamon Bear.
Well, you know, that's seasonal.
We like the suspense, the seasonal.
I like the Johnny Dollar.
Great.
I love those 15-minute Bob Bailey shows. You know, I like the Phil Harris Show.
Oh, Phil Harris and Alice Faye, right?
Yeah, and I think the. The Edgar Bergen Show was really a funny show. Fibber McGee and Molly, the writing was fantastic.
Mm-hmm. For those who would like more information about Heather McAdams, her artwork, and her Everything Plus Country calendar for 2017, you can email her directly at heathermcadams@hotmail.com. You can learn about Chris Ligon's music and his various CDs by emailing him at chrisligon@hotmail.com. And again, the last name is Ligon. I can't thank you enough for being a part of this.
Really. It's really nice. I appreciate you asking, and we were very excited to have you come over.
If we were to play a song of yours that maybe we have alluded to or haven't talked about at all, what would you like us to play? Something old, something new?
How about, you want to hear the song, what about Florida?
Let's do it.
Want to do that?
Florida. Chris Ligon, Heather McAdams, thank you again for joining us on this edition of the podcast.
Thank you, Steve. Nice to see you.
Appreciate it.
Let's do some flips and shake our hips and save our tips and take a trip to Florida. Florida. We'll pack a sack with bric-a-brac, take a train on a track, we'll never come back from Florida.
Chris Legan and his song Florida from a 2009 compilation CD called Look at the Birdie. Our thanks to Chris Legan and Heather McAdams for joining us on this fifth anniversary edition of the Nostalgia Digest podcast. We were talking about the golden age of radio with Chris and Heather, and knowing that they're fond of Jack Benny, and in fact knowing that many of us are fond of Jack Benny, it seemed appropriate to share a few moments of Jack Benny's radio career with you now. This is an excerpt from a Jack Benny program that was originally heard over CBS for Lucky Strike Cigarettes on October 30th, 1949. And it's especially appropriate to share this with you on our fifth anniversary podcast because this show was devoted to announcer Don Wilson, who was celebrating his 25th anniversary in radio. And in addition to Jack and Don, you'll also hear from some of the regulars on the Benny program, Mary Livingston, singer Dennis Day, the great Mel Blanc, the Sportsman Quartet, and special guest Frank Sinatra, who does a little singing and a little comedy. Let's go back to October 30th of 1949, we're celebrating our anniversary as Don Wilson celebrates an anniversary on the Jack Benny program.
Now, where were we?
We were talking about my anniversary.
Oh, yes. Ladies and gentlemen, for our feature attraction tonight, we... Come in.
Hi, Jack.
Well, look who's here, Frank Sinatra.
Say, I hope I'm not interrupting anything.
Not at all, Frank. Not at all.
It's good to see you, Frank.
It certainly is, Frank.
Yes, we feel quite honored.
What do you need him for when you got me?
Dennis, believe me, the fact that Sinatra's here is no reflection on your ability.
It isn't, Mr. Benny?
No, kid. You see, I'm glad Sinatra's here because he's one of the greatest singers in the country.
Frank, I was supposed to read that.
I know, Jack, but when I see a line like that in the script, I like to stroke it a while.
Oh.
So he's one of the greatest singers in the country, huh?
Yes, he is.
How many shows has he got?
One.
Heh!
Dennis, be quiet. Tell me, Frank, when did you get back from the East?
Last week, Jack. I would have been back a little sooner, but I was on one of those local trains, and it stopped at every town.
Oh.
Going through New Jersey, we stopped at Newark, Passaic, Red Bank, Plainfield, Elizabeth,
Hey,
Hohoke.
Frank,
yes?
If you stopped in Plainfield, maybe you saw my sister, Babe.
No, I didn't, Mary. In fact, I didn't even get off at Plainfield. We just stopped there for 5 minutes to take on a new engineer.
That was Babe.
Oh. Oh, then that explains it.
Explains what?
It's the first time I ever saw a pair of overalls with a plunging neckline.
Look, I'm sure there are other things that we can discuss besides the adventures of Casey Livingston.
I'm sorry.
Say, Jack, I meant to ask you, how do you feel since you came home from the hospital?
Oh, I'm fine now, Frank. Really okay.
I'm glad to hear that. But you know, you'll never have to go to the hospital again if you take care of yourself like I do.
Like you do?
Well, yes, Jack. My system of keeping healthy is very simple. I get up bright and early every morning, take 15 minutes of exercise, and then they bring me a large glass of orange juice. What a workout.
Workout? Drinking a glass of orange juice?
Who drinks it? I swim in it.
Oh.
And getting around those seeds is murder.
I wouldn't know.
Yes, sir. And then I take 10 minutes of deep breathing exercises. That's the way I've developed my chest to what it is today, you know.
Oh, I see. I see. And Frankie, what is your chest measurement normally?
34 inches.
And what is it expanded?
32.
Well, how come your chest is 2 inches smaller when it's expanded?
I don't know. I must have a slow leak somewhere.
Well, that I can't understand at all, including my lead line.
No, slowly. Oh, that's funny. Now, that's very funny.
Now, Moby Dick.
Moby Dick? That's no way to talk to me after I took this program when it was down.
It wasn't down. I was a big success all over New York, Chicago, and they loved me in St. Joe.
And they're crazy about me in Czechoslovakia.
Yes, I read about it.
Anyway, Jack, you shouldn't be so hard on Don. After all, he is celebrating his silver anniversary in radio.
That's beside the point, Frank. Say, how'd you know this was his silver anniversary?
Why wouldn't I know? Don's the announcer on my Lucky Strike program, Light Up Time.
That's right, Jack. I broadcast with Frankie 5 times a week.
Gosh, Frank, I didn't realize you were on 5 times a week. A half hour each program?
No, 15 minutes.
Ha! Dennis, keep quiet!
Well, Jack, you see, that's one of the reasons I came over here today. I cooked up a little song especially for Don, and the Sportsman Quintet's going to assist me.
The Sportsman Quintet?
Yes, this is a special arrangement, and it was necessary to add Mel Blanc.
Oh, that guy gets in on everything. Well, go ahead, Frankie, let's hear it. Don, this is especially for you.
You must have been a beautiful baby. You must have been a wonderful child. When you were only starting to go to kindergarten, I bet you drove the little girls wild. And when it came to winning blue ribbon, I bet you showed the other kids how.
That's Mel Blanc.
I can hear the judges wail as you stepped upon the scale. You were so fat you couldn't bow. Hey, you must have been a beautiful baby, 'cause baby, look at you now.
Take it, boys.
You must be waiting for the commercial. You must expect the Lucky Strike song. And that was our intention, but now we have to mention that something went a little bit wrong. We couldn't find the brand of tobacco, the word the Speedy Rigs would allow. We tried everything, you see, even LSMFT. We thought that that would work somehow. So we guess we'll have to skip the commercial and light up a Lucky right now.
Okay, I'll join you.
Let's light a Lucky right now.
You know they pay more.
Let's light a Lucky right now.
Frank, that was swell, and I appreciate your dropping over.
My pleasure, Jack.
Well, look, Frank, as long as you're here, would you like to take part in a little play that I wrote based on the life of Don Wilson?
Why, it'll be peachy. What part will I play?
Well, you can be Don's father, and Mary, you're going to be Don's mother.
Gee, that means I'm Frankie's wife.
That's right.
See, that's wonderful. I always wanted an engineer for a sister-in-law.
Yeah, just, now, come on, let's get on with it. Ladies and gentlemen, in honor of Don Wilson's 25th year in radio, we're going to present a play based on his life. The Don Wilson Story, or Life Can Be Plentiful. Curtain. Music. Our story opens in Denver, Colorado, many years ago. The stork has just delivered a precious bundle to the home of Mr. and Mrs. Donald C. Wilson, Sr. The mother happily whispers to the father,
"Darling, it's a boy."
And the proud father said,
"Yes, aren't we lucky? The stork brought us a boy."
And the stork said,
"Oh, my aching back."
As the proud parents leaned over the crib looking at their newborn son, the baby said, "Meow." 3 days later, the baby said,
"I want a T-bone steak."
He was developing slowly. The next day, a friendly neighbor dropped in to see this little bundle of joy.
"You must be the happiest couple in Denver. Let me see the little fellow."
There he is in his crib. Isn't he a chubby baby?
Ooh, is he?
The next day, another neighbor dropped in, and the mother said,
"Don't you think we have a cute baby?"
"Nah."
And the following day, the sister-in-law dropped in. She couldn't stop. She was taking a fast freight to Frisco. Later that evening, the proud father was trying to put little Donald to sleep.
"Now, come on, baby. Company's gone, and it's Betty by time. Now, baby, stop that. Baby, stop.
Baby, put me down."
You better let me have him, dear.
All right, darling.
Now, Donald, close your little eyes and Mommy will sing you to sleep. Rock-a-bye, baby, in the treetop. When the wind blows, the cradle will rock. If the bough breaks, the cradle will fall. Down will come Donald, Denver and all. Look, dear, he's asleep.
When Donald was 6 years old, he sent him to school. The teacher looked up at him and said,
"And now I'd like you children to recite the alphabet. Donald Wilson, you go first."
"A, B, C, D, E, F, G, H, I, J, K, L, S, M, F, T."
"That's correct, Donald."
The teacher used to work for the Board of Education, but Lucky's paid more. The years passed quickly, and Don graduated from college, magna cum laude. He went out to seek his fortune in radio. It was tough for him to get a job. First, he applied to that famous comedian, Fred Allen.
"I think this is the street Mr. Allen lives on. I'll try this house."
"Howdy, Bob."
"Pardon me, sir, but I'm looking for Fred Allen."
"You mean the fellow who's as corny as Kansas in August?"
"Yes."
"Never heard of him."
He tried the next door.
"Ah, what's going on here? Now, what are you doing at that? Ah, how do you do? How do you do?"
"Well, pardon me, sir, but I'm looking for Fred Allen."
"You mean that fellow with the blarney stone under each eye?"
"Yes."
"Never heard of him."
He tried the next door.
"Yes."
"Pardon me, sir. Are you Fred Allen?"
"I would answer that, but I have no place to put all the prizes." "Goodbye, son."
Don didn't get the job, but he never stopped trying. He was driven on by ambition, perseverance, tenacity, and Schwartz. They were his agents. So next day, he went to see another big star of that era.
"Do you think you can use me on your radio program, Mr. Jolson?"
"Ah."
Then Donald left New York and came to Hollywood to seek his fortune. Babe drove him out. When Donald arrived in Hollywood, he lost no time in making an appointment with the greatest comedian that the world has ever known. A star whose position in the entertainment world has never been challenged. It was with fear and trepidation that Don went to the home of this great, great star. Yes? What can I do for you?
Are you Jack Benny, the greatest comedian the world has ever known? The star whose position in the entertainment world has never been challenged?
Ooh, am I?
So Don Wilson came to work for me, and he has been my announcer ever since. This made his father so happy that he flew out from Denver, climbed up on Don's knee, and sang...
And when it came to winning blue ribbons, I knew you'd show the other kids how. With your voice so strong and clear, we're so glad that you are here. So stand right up and take a bow.
Oh, you must have been a beautiful baby, 'cause Don Z, look at you now.
I'll lift your option.
Don Z, look at you now.
An excerpt from a Jack Benny program, heard originally over CBS for Lucky Strike Cigarettes on October 30th, 1949, featuring Mary Livingston, Dennis Day, the great Mel Blanc, the Sportsman Quartet, Frank Sinatra, and Don Wilson, the announcer who was celebrating his 25th anniversary in radio, just as we are celebrating the 5th anniversary of the Nostalgia Digest podcast. And just a reminder, the Nostalgia Shop at NostalgiaDigest.com has more than 30 hours of Jack Benny's radio career on compact disc, with collections including Jack Benny and World War II, Jack Benny the Holiday Shows, I Can't Stand Jack Benny Because. You'll find these collections and many others when you visit the Nostalgia Shop at NostalgiaDigest.com. It's always a delight to share these wonderful sounds from the golden age of radio with you. It's also been a delight to share some conversations from the first 5 years of the Nostalgia Digest podcast. It's been an enormous pleasure to get to speak with so many interesting and talented people and share their stories through these monthly podcasts. We'd like to conclude this anniversary edition of the podcast by taking you back to May of 2015, for an excerpt from Nostalgia Digest podcast number 41. Our conversation with the voice of the Chicago Cubs, announcer Pat Hughes. We had contacted Pat Hughes to talk about his Baseball Voices series, devoted to famous sportscasters who had appeared during the golden age of radio. But of course, in spring, a young man's fancy eventually turns to discussing the baseball season. In your career, you've worked with three gentlemen, all of whom are featured in your Baseball Voices series, and all of whom, coincidentally or otherwise, are in the Baseball Hall of Fame: Bob Uecker, Harry Carey, and Ron Santo. Now, these were three very different gentlemen. I know they had differing styles, but I wonder if, having worked with all three of them up close and personal, if you can find a common thread between them, if there was anything they shared that made them as good as they were at what they did.
I think immediately, Steve, and that's a great question, the thing that links the three of those guys, Santo, Uecker, and Carey, they loved baseball. Mm-hmm. They loved baseball in the towns where they were working. Ron Santo is the number one Cub fan, in addition to being one of the all-time great players. Nobody, no former star player, loves his former team the way Santo loved the Chicago Cubs. Bob Uecker was born and raised in Milwaukee, loves the Brewers, and loves the game. Harry Carey, interesting thing about Harry, he was from St. Louis, He spent about 25 years as a Cardinal announcer before he was fired in 1969. And then he did 1 year in Oakland and then I think 11 years with the White Sox before joining the Cubs in 1982. And yet because of his unique charismatic personality, it seemed like Harry Carey, after only a year or two, had been here forever. And that's a real rare gift that Harry Carey had. If you hear recordings of his 1984 work, for example, of Ryan Sandberg hitting the two home runs off Bruce Sutter in June of 84, it sounds like Harry Carey has been the voice of the Cubs for 30 years. It was only his third season. But I would say the three of them loved baseball, loved fans, and really, for a lot of guys, I think baseball announcing is not just what they do, but it's who they are. And their entire identity is wrapped up in being, you know, the voice of the Brewers or the voice of the Cardinals or the voice of the Cubs. And I think they would rather work than not work. I mean, even if they didn't need the money, they would rather be at the ballpark than anywhere else. And that's just that's why the three of them have lasted as long as they did.
And Pat Hughes, thank you so much for joining us today and sharing your memories and your knowledge of the game and the broadcasters who have made it so fascinating all these years. And perhaps this will be the year.
Well, I hope so. I'm ready for that. And again, going back to broadcast history, when the Cubs do win the pennant or win the World Series, the thought has occurred to me many times, Steve, that nobody has ever heard a radio broadcaster for the Cubs say, the Cubs are the world champions, because the last time they won that was 1908, and that was about 15 years before they ever even started broadcasting radio of big league ball. So there was no recording. Nobody was announcing games back in 1908. And in 1945, the last time the Cubs won the pennant, if there's a recording of that moment, I've never heard it. I'm pretty sure it does not exist. I couldn't tell you if it was Burt Wilson or whomever announcing for the Cubs at that time, but when they won the pennant in 1945, I've never heard the announcer or the recording. So when I hope I'm the guy. That's what I'm trying to say. I hope I'm the guy that says, the Cubs won the pennant, or the Cubs won the World Series, or the Cubs are the world champs, or goodbye Billy Goat, or whatever, whatever it's going to be. And, you know, that's going to be an exciting moment. So I hope that happens.
An excerpt from our conversation with the voice of the Chicago Cubs, Mr. Pat Hughes, who spoke with us about his Baseball Voices series for the May 2015 Nostalgia Digest podcast. And in fact, in November of 2016, Pat Hughes made radio history by being the first voice in Chicago broadcasting to ever announce that the Chicago Cubs were the world champions of baseball. Our conversation with Pat Hughes can be found on the Nostalgia Digest Podcast 2015 CD. It's one of a dozen MP3 files, adding up to more than 9 hours of classic Golden Age entertainment. And that CD is available from the podcast page at nostalgiadigest.com. We're grateful to everyone who has made the Nostalgia Digest podcast possible over these last 5 years. Especially, we're grateful to you for your kindness, your support, your encouragement. We thank you. And we hope you will join us in 2017 as we begin the 6th year of the Nostalgia Digest podcast. The Nostalgia Digest podcast is brought to you by NostalgiaDigest.com, the home of Nostalgia Digest magazine, the quarterly publication dedicated to chronicling and celebrating the golden age of entertainment. NostalgiaDigest.com is also the home of the Audiophile Nostalgia Shop, offering hundreds of hours of classic old-time radio on compact disc. And if you've enjoyed the conversations you've heard on this 5th anniversary edition of our podcast, we hope you'll check out collections like Radio's Great Detective Shows, Radio's Great Mystery Adventure Shows, our 2-CD set old-time radio goes to the old ball game, are more than 30 hours of the radio career of Jack Benny. You'll find all this and much, much more at NostalgiaDigest.com. And for the Nostalgia Digest podcast, this is Steve Darnall speaking. Thanks for listening.